Do you want to read books that challenge capitalism and give you tools to fight back against oppression? Surviving Society is partnering with radical independent publisher Pluto Press to bring you books by exciting young authors, as well as classics by writers who defined our movements.
Throughout 2024, you can grab 50% off all books on their website by using the code SURVIVING50. Go to plutobooks.com to check out the books.
Welcome to Surviving Society Presents, the Black Health and Humanities Network podcast. These episodes focus on the politics of black health in modern society.
Welcome to another episode of Surviving Society. This is a special series we've been doing with the Black Health and Humanities Network. I am really excited today to be in conversation with Dr. Kelechi Anucha. I emphasise the doctor because you've just passed your PhD and submitted. Oh, yeah. You've submitted and just passed your PhD. That's right, Kelechi.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. Huge. Yeah. It feels weird and really great to be able to say that.
Huge congratulations. Bashment horns, please, George. It's so amazing to have someone like you on the show, Kelechi, for so many reasons, but particularly because your passion, as you've shared with me, comes down to the focus on collaborative research, but also research that relates to everyday life. I know we're going to be talking a bit about the work you were doing via the University of Exeter and Wellcome, in particular looking at the Waiting Time project that looked at the temporalities of healthcare in the UK. Was it in the UK only?
Yeah, it was in the UK, but as we'll probably become clear, some of my research has kind of veered into a kind of US context, which has been interesting, something that I've been reflecting on and maybe we can discuss. But yeah,
amazing. And like, honestly, listeners, whilst you're listening to this, take a look at the Waiting Times Project website. It is so cool. Like, I know obviously Waiting Times aren't actually cool, but like the way you've digitized it is so impressive and really sort of emphasizes this turn within scholarship and particularly health scholarship that's making it more accessible and more relatable to everyday life.
Brilliant. I'm glad it resonates. That's great.
Definitely.
To hear.
So Kelechi, can we start from the beginning? How did you get into this research, and like, how would you kind of outline the themes of the research that you're interested in?
Absolutely. It's great to have an opportunity to speak to kind of the lived experience side of this project. So basically, the waiting times, temporalities of healthcare, within that there's like different streams, and there was an advert for this PhD opportunity, and I was really excited because it was an opportunity to think about, this was the mandate, to think about end of life narratives and think about the temporalities of end of life narratives and think about how time and care are related to one another in this particular genre. Mm. And that was interesting for several reasons. For my own experience, coming from a Nigerian family, where one of my kind of formative experiences was my mum's illness during my teenage years. And she was ill for a long time with breast cancer. And that was an experience that's really shaped me and my sisters. It's a bit of a joke. We've all kind of gone into kind of health adjacent kind of fields. My sister's a doctor, and I'm obviously kind of moving into medical humanities. So healthcare from a humanities perspective, that was a unique experience to be able to reflect on some of these experiences of thinking about illness, death and dying, and the kind of temporal kind of resonances of those experiences as well. So going into the project, had this kind of very open brief, think about time and care in relation to end of life narratives. And I ended up being able to kind of really shape that and allow it to reflect my own kind of lived experience. Maybe you can relate to this, like sometimes the kind of most interesting kind of directions in scholarship emerge from a sense of kind of frustration. What am I not seeing? What am I looking for but not being able to kind of find it in this space? So I was really interested in this kind of idea of end of life narratives, as a kind of subsect of a kind of literary genre of writing, the illness narrative genre. So memoir, life writing, I guess kind of biographical kind of texts about the experience of serious illness, death, dying, and that kind of thing. And so thinking about that genre and thinking about the kind of cultures and conventions of that genre was really interesting, but also being able to reflect on, while these narratives are really compelling, particularly kind of cancer narratives that kind of track, I was noticing that they were tracking this kind of quite linear progression through a series of stages that kind of reflected, in a sense, the way that I guess a kind of medical perspective, where you have the moment of diagnosis, then you have a treatment, then you have a kind of entering a prognosis phase where there's either a kind of an expectation of recovery, or in unfortunate cases, death, and things enter a palliative stage. So I was really noticing that the narratives that were kind of popular, that kind of received the most critical and cultural attention, were narratives that kind of progressed through these stages, but also narratives that kind of had the individual at their core. So this individual struggle with health and the idea, I guess, that we often hear repeated in the context of health, that it's a kind of fight, that someone either won their battle with cancer or sadly lost their battle with cancer, and it's this kind of very individual kind of struggle. And so I was interested in that, and often, you know, I found a lot of these narratives, like, personally very compelling, as someone who kind of been through this process of bereavement, but also I was kind of called to reflect actually on, well, actually, what's missing here? And often I found that these narratives centered a kind of white perspective. And also that they kind of, yeah, there was a sense of kind of, there was a cultural sense of, and there's a scholar, Roger Luckhurst, talks about this kind of particular subsection of white kind of intelligentsia who are producing these types of narratives. So people who have existing platforms as journalists, as writers, as artists, as kind of critical thinkers, had platforms to produce these types of narratives, and there was a real appetite to kind of hear these stories, but also a sense in which these narratives are approached as a kind of universal intervention or a universal representation. At least that was how I was seeing that they were received, as like, this is something that, because we all die, this is a kind of narrative form that can apply and be relevant to everyone. And that was something that I really wanted to challenge and interrogate. But actually, looking through these narratives, there's a sense in which you're always kind of looking for what you've lost. And there was a sense in which I kind of was hoping to have this moment of recognition of not only my own experience of bereavement, but, my mum's own experience of going through this experience of cancer diagnosis and illness. But that was something that, despite how compelling I found these narratives, that really didn't happen. So I wanted to think about how are race and socioeconomic status kind of implicated in what sorts of narratives emerge, illness narratives can emerge and in this space, in a cultural space. So yeah.
Kalaichi, honestly, thank you so, so much for sharing that with us. I'm just going to sort of signal to the listeners for a second before I come back to some of the things that you've said. Like, this is one of the beauties and uniqueness of surviving society, and that we don't over prepare or over produce what we're going to talk about on the show, or how I or guest hosts will engage with listeners. We bring people in because we know they're interested and interesting, they're doing social research, or they're commenting on societal issues in a way that centres inequality and social justice. The reason why I draw on that after everything that you've just been saying, Kalaichi, is because I didn't know that that was your kind of route into this work. And listeners will know for me that conversations around cancer, care, death, life after death is incredibly personal. And actually, like for me personally, is very personal and very much guides a lot of my politics now when it comes to talking about matters of love, life and death. So in hearing you talk about cancer in such an intimate way, just to sort of say some of the listeners as well, that my husband died of cancer in March 2022. And hearing you talk in this way about how much, well, how important it was to find or to seek out recognition, representation of you as a Black Nigerian woman, but also for your mum, like it rings so true. And I just want to say that I'm so grateful for you sharing this, but also I'm so grateful for the platform that you've generated yourself through that experience of palliative care with an intimate family member. Like, that is such incredible scholarship and representation for, like, the cancer community. In the cancer community, I'm including people that have lived with, cared for, or are in life after cancer or life after chronic health. And I think that hearing younger people talk about this is what we need as well.
So yeah, I mean, actually, absolutely responding to that, like, you know, what an amazing kind of where a place to meet together today. That's really, I feel really grateful for the opportunity. And just to say thank you also for sharing that. And yeah, especially in this kind of moment of, you know, this first year.
I think that one of the things that's so important about temporality, and it would be good to hear some of your reflections on this based on your PhD research, but temporality is so crucial when we're talking about death. And I think that, well, death and chronic health and palliative care, and I think temporality is important because so often I feel like time carries on but nothing changes. And like, by nothing changes, I mean the feelings around, like, loss and grief and death, like they don't change, but time carries on, or everyone else carries on, and their idea of temporality is what we have to align ourselves with. So okay, it's been 18 months since my husband died, I need to start getting better now because everyone else says that time's carried on. And like, when you said that, yeah, the waiting times being such a key part of the project, I sort of assumed, oh, this project is centering kind of GP appointments, but actually you were talking about life, death, love, grief. And yeah, it just rings so true. And I wondered if you could speak more about this kind of emphasis on temporality.
Absolutely. And that was kind of a key, talking about some of the key concepts that emerged from the research. That was something that kind of I wanted to very early on find a way to talk about, this idea of, and I ended up kind of conceptually framing it in terms of kind of temporal incommensibility. So the idea that time does, like, there's kind of experiences of temporality that don't align. And I was particularly interested in thinking about this from a kind of the perspective of race, and particularly Blackness. So thinking about Charles Mills's kind of conceptualization of white time, and thinking about how he frames that, and how waiting times and waiting is often kind of, you know, there's a highly racialized element to who waits when and for what reason. So that was kind of something I really wanted to bring into the research. And, you know, we have these conversations kind of as part of the project. There's different streams, and some of my colleagues are talking about the GP kind of surgery as a site of waiting, where that kind of waiting gets articulated as the kind of, you know, as the kind of gatekeeping to all the specialist services. So the waiting list, you know, as a site there. And also kind of thinking about other forms of waiting, particularly kind of sensitive forms of waiting. So for people who are questioning their gender, for people who are trans, thinking about the way that they are, you know, they are basically forced to wait at this moment, and thinking about, you know, the violence and the kind of really the kind of dynamics of these different types of waiting at different points. So I'm thinking about that kind of moment of waiting that's essentially kind of the waiting at the end of life, where there's nothing to do but be with the person. You know, there's no intervention, there's nothing that's going to happen or change. There's a kind of really a call to be with the other. And so, yeah, I guess that was in our different ways across the project. We were thinking about forms of non-progressive time. What does it mean to kind of, and so one of the PIs on the project, Lisa Baratza, kind of has this formulation. So waiting can involve different forms of kind of extended temporalities, so forms of delay, forms of suspension, forms of breaking off, breaking down, you know, and thinking about what opportunities, but also kind of, you know, acknowledging really the potential for violence within that kind of space of waiting. But what kind of opportunities does it offer? What kind of forms of intersubjective kind of encounter can it stage? You know, that time of waiting at the end of life is a hugely kind of, yet has a huge potential to be a really meaningful, you know, opportunity for a kind of exchange and a meeting of people, and thinking about how, you know, our politics can be transformed by those moments. I'm thinking of at the beginning of In the Wake, Christina Sharpe's In the Wake, and she talks about that encounter at the bedside, mm-hmm. as a real moment of her brother, and, you know, enormously moving, but, you know, really a really kind of exciting kind of potential to think about what it means to care and what it means to be with someone and what it means to be alongside someone, you know, in extremis, really. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I'm just thinking about what you said earlier in terms of how these things or waiting is racialized and classed, but also contextual and situational. So like more recent contexts around death concerning like COVID-19 and the pandemic, like again, sort of drawing on the death of my husband, the waiting time was very much conditioned by, at the time, the Omicron variant. So what it meant was when we were effectively waiting for my husband to die, and it took him like 2 weeks to actually die, and then in the kind of days in which he was dying, it was 3 days, a very intense 3 days where he couldn't be left on his own. But like, I draw on that because at that time, like, he did not want to be in a hospice. He wanted to be at home. But we were not able to access, you can only have a certain amount of morphine in your house. Yes. And so it meant that every time he needed pain relief, a substantial amount of pain relief, we had to call the community nurse to come. Obviously, this is at a time when loads of the community nurses are off sick because they've got COVID. So it meant that kind of waiting time was incredibly, incredibly difficult for me and my family, because there was so much pain intertwined within that process of waiting for death. And there's just so many things that you've said that sort of, yeah, relate to my own experience of, yeah, care and cancer and palliative care in particular. And apologies for the kind of indulgent, like self-indulgent relating to
not at all. I think it absolutely has to be kind of, it's an absolutely a part of your kind of research identity. I don't think the two can be separated. And, you know, was debating for a long time, like, how can I talk about this? And for a long time, I did resist kind of bringing that in, because there's a kind of, as you're kind of learning the conventions of this strange world of academia, there's a sense in which, you know, oh God, how can I talk about my own experience and still kind of maintain this kind of veneer of objectivity, of rigor, of all the rest of it. So I think I'm absolutely, you know, I absolutely think that these experiences must be integrated into our thinking. They are already integrated into our thinking. So it's about, I guess, being able to kind of articulate that.
I think it's as well, like, what you're doing for me, Kelechi, is like, it's quite overwhelming, because I've never actually heard someone be able to really articulate what death and grief and palliative care and waiting is, the theory of that, and how that then maps onto what how it's lived in social life. So it's easy for me to kind of sit here and talk about, oh, it was terrible, like my husband dying, like it's so painful, like grief is terrible. Like, I can talk about the emotions of it. And I do have some of the theory around it, but actually like what you're doing and what you've done in this project is so novel to me. I'm sure there's obviously other research, but just hearing it in this way, like what you've basically articulated back to me this, like what happened, but in a way that I've not heard it before. And it's really comforting, especially because, as you know, like if you're involved in a care team or you experience cancer intimately, or you experience death intimately, you automatically become part of a group that's separate from your other groups. So it's so having that kind of relatability with people, you constantly feel like you're away from people because they can't embody or walk alongside the things that you're speaking back to me. So I think it's as well kind of feeling that, like, in this moment with you, I feel seen as well.
I really appreciate that. This has been a really valuable conversation already. So thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been great.
Yeah. And so, I mean, in terms of how people have engaged with the work so far and the conversations you've had, where are you seeing the kind of hope around this work, particularly in thinking about, waiting, race, care, and how we're able to talk about it in a way that recognises the structures of society and how they map onto the experiences of this?
Absolutely. So it's been, I mean, there's two kind of parts of this kind of research project that I'm still kind of bringing together conceptually and kind of intellectually. The first opportunity, one of the first things that I did, my background is in literary studies, so kind of, you know, English literature undergrad, you know, did a master's in comparative literature.
And where then, did you do you know, your where did you do your degrees?
So did my undergrad at Leeds.
Lovely. Oh, they've got great English people there.
It's a really good program. I mean it's like such a fun city, like as someone kind of living in the south, it was my first experience of a northern city. It's just hard to kind of, it's hard to think about going back south after that. And then I did my MA at Goldsmiths and then down to Exeter for the PhD.
So I did my PhD at Goldsmiths alumni. Oh. Buddies.
Yeah, I mean, that's so fun, isn't it?
Yeah,
being in South London. So yeah, That was a really amazing experience. But just as the kind of first experience in the PhD was to my colleague, Dr. Michael Flexer on the project, designed this kind of program of engaged research. And the first kind of stage in this program was to undertake a series of storytelling workshops, in a day hospice in rural Devon. So that was like a really kind of interesting experience. Like, it's the first time I stepped back into a hospice since I'd been in a hospice when my mum was passing.
Of course, yeah.
So that was a really bizarre experience. But also just kind of thinking of the temporalities of that, it was like a strange kind of, I was still living kind of just outside of London. So I was getting the train to Exeter. And so there was this kind of rush. Then you arrive at the hospice and then there's this kind of temporal kind of, it was like stepping into a different kind of temporality.
It is, because hospices are very particular. Like, obviously, there's some incredible, like, honestly, the people that work in hospices are incredible. Like, honestly, they're the heroes of society in my eyes. Like, incredible. But also, like, I found the space incredibly just traumatic. I can't imagine going back into, I'm going to have to, because death is a certainty. So I will have to go back into hospice at some point. But, like, to go back, for you going back, having been a carer, then going back as a researcher, that must have been, well, what was that like?
It was a really fascinating experience in that, it's been over 10 years now since my mum passed. And so just in the experiences, I was reflecting on kind of how memory works and thinking about, but also just, you know, thinking about how unique these spaces are, but how there's a kind of sense of resonance between them. So my mum passed in a hospice in Windsor shout out Thames Valley Hospice. They took care of her so well.
Thames Valley.
You know, I'll always support them because, yeah, as you say, just the work that they do is just really transformative. Mm. Being able to kind of cater to our needs, like when you've got like 20 plus kind of our whole diasporic family, we had relatives from Nigeria, we were around the bedside, we were singing, singing around the bedside. I don't know, like they must have had a nightmare with us, like, you know.
Yeah, big up Royal Trinity Hospice too for my family. Anyway, carry on, sorry.
No, it's fine, it's fine. It's just that kind of thing of like we're mourning, we're already kind of, it's already such a culturally specific experience of being with this person who's passing and, you know, mourning. And so they were able to take that into account. So I was really interested to go back into this space in Devon and notice the kind of similarities. I mean, there's like a kind of a sense in which spatially and kind of atmospherically, there was a kind of sense of connection between those spaces, which I found fascinating. And just being able, just having to kind of change pace when you come into this space as well was really interesting. There was an anticipation of what it might be like to be in hospice in the southwest, in a space like Devon, where there isn't the same ethnic diversity even that you get kind of in the suburbs of London, which is where I grew up. Noticing how we were able to find meeting spaces, the kind of service users at the hospice, between kind of, you know, we were separated generationally, we're separated kind of culturally, but we were able to kind of come together and have, so there was a really strange and kind of interesting moment where we were talking about, some of the older service users were talking about these like blueies, these airmail letters that they used to send to each other. I think some of them saw a kind of active service during the Second World War, and they were talking about how that was how they conducted their courtship. And then my colleague Michael Flexer was talking about this kind of object, the kind of airmail letter, as something that he also recognised. And I was like, hang on a minute, when my mum and dad were like essentially dating, my dad was in Nigeria, my mum was in the UK, that was how they wrote to each other. And there's a box of these airmail letters at home of just them writing to each other and just getting to know each other. So that was a really kind of an interesting moment where we were able to find a meeting point. And I think in a sense, like I think Yasmin Gunaratram talks about the hospice as this kind of space of intervalent kind of, it's a meeting space, it's an interstice where these kind of different kind of cultural roots and roots kind of intersect. And
yes,
that was really an experience that I had kind of coming back into the hospice at the early stages of the research, but also kind of interesting kind of like meeting space between kind of literary studies and what might be kind of loosely kind of experienced as a kind of social science methodology. In a sense, we were kind of quote unquote collecting methodological or a qualitative data, in the sense that we're kind of, you know, having these stories and we're kind of recording them and transcribing them and then offering them back to the service users as you know, documents, as books, as kind of legacy work that marks our time together. So yeah, that was interesting.
Oh, that's incredible, Kelechi. Like so much there, so much. And like, yeah, I've just been thinking so much about representation of like death and grief and palliative care. So to hear about this work that you've been doing, that the team have been doing, is just so incredible. So just kind of to finish up, Kelechi, honestly, I could talk to you about this all day, but like, where do you think the hope lies in terms of representations of death, the intergenerational nature of it, the racialized and class nature of it, and palliative care? Like, where do you think we need to go as a society in terms of how we talk about and relate to these matters? As we've said on this show, on this episode, like, death is the only certainty, so we need to do a bit of a PR campaign on death.
Absolutely.
Is my thoughts. Yeah.
Yeah, the title of my PhD was Out of Time: Temporality, Form and Fugitive Care in Contemporary literature and Culture.
So can I just ask you something?
Yes.
Out of Time, is that a lyric? Is that a blur?
No, it's not.
Oh,
but it's
okay.
Like such a resonant kind of, like, I was kind of, there was a point at which I was like, I felt like I was hearing it everywhere. And then it spoke to this sense of kind of temporal incrementability that I wanted to talk about, this sense of being you know, out of this kind of linear flow of progressing time.
Okay.
This non-progressive time. So yeah, anyway.
Okay, the reason I ask. The reason I ask, you need to check out, so I'm a really big rock and roll fan. Blur, Out of Time is one of my favorite Blur songs. Listen to that and listen to the lyrics. That's amazing. And anyway, sorry, carry on. I had to be like, is everyone got a Blur fan here? But yeah, accidental lyric use, but the lyrics of Out of Time are beautiful. So yeah, check it out. Anyway, carry on.
Will do. I will do. I like a bit of Blur. I will say that. Good. This is a kind of tangent. So where the kind of hope came in for me. And so I'm super aware that kind of the idea of fugitivity is a kind of concept that's kind of, you know, it's been really interesting to see the kind of currency the concept has been gaining lately as an opportunity to talk about, a different temporality, a different orientation to, to politics and to resistance. And that's been really interesting to see how these different conversations, how it's been kind of taken up. And I wanted to kind of wanted to engage with some of the ways it's been formulated by Moten, by Hartman, and by Sharp as an orientation, to an elsewhere, but also as an opportunity to think through a different relationship to time. So that was where that came in. And also a kind of a hopeful orientation to time. That's that sense of being between, in the between spaces. So not having arrived, but kind of, you know, being oriented to somewhere else. And I think that was something that really kind of resonated for me in thinking about. I was able to kind of engage with Edward Danshakat's Brother I'm Dying. I don't know if you've read that memoir, and some work by Jessamine Ward, and really thinking about the kind of fugitive temporalities which kind of underpin and are interwoven into these representations of death and dying. That was a really transformative and hopeful experience, actually, and I was able to kind of really draw out the ways in which this can offer us a different way to think about being, thinking about value, thinking about relation, and thinking about kind of the intergenerational, not only as a kind of way in which harm accretes intergenerationally. So that was something that really emerged from this idea that in my thesis that while you have this kind of heroic individual cancer narrative, what I was finding when I was looking for, experiences of illness, death, cancer from a Black perspective, I was finding that these narratives are interwoven with kind of intergenerational stories. They're located in different formal containers. So you've got poetry, you've got fiction, and you've got this kind of sense in which you can't just talk about yourself, that you can't, you know, you can't unpick that from a wider kind of sense of the fabric of the social, at least from a Black perspective. That was my finding. And so that was a hopeful thing, because it's hopeful to be social. It's hopeful to be integrated. It's hopeful to be part of something. And I know that's something that's really sustained me, you know, being like this with my mum's brothers and sisters and her, you know, my cousins, that was something that really gave me life. You know, in the aftermath of her death.
Oh, Kalechi, honestly, you have to believe me when I say this. This has been my favourite episode of this year.
Come on.
It's been my favourite episode of this year. Selfishly, because you're talking about my life, basically. but also because these are things that I think about every single day, and like having someone speak back to you your experience, like, this is what sociology, social sciences is all about, isn't it? Like the power in knowledge production, the power in ideas, the power in research, the power in scholarship to help us with our understandings of our sense of selves in relation to how we live our lives in relation to structures of society. And I'm so grateful for you. The gift that you've given me this morning is one of an acceptance, but also of recognition and being seen. And you can't buy that. It's beautiful. And I'm so, so grateful for your work. And I'm so excited to, yeah, get to know more about what you're doing, because you really are doing some incredible work. And I hope you don't mind me saying, but your mum would be so incredibly proud of you.
Oh my gosh, that is, you know, that is one of the best things I can ever hear. You know, that's, you know, that's my dearest hope, that I can, you know, in some way express what an honour it was to know her.
Yeah. You're amazing, Kelechi. Listeners,
thank you so much.
Thank you so much for bearing with us, or not bearing with us, for sitting with Kelechi and I as we talk about all things love, death, grief and waiting. In the episode notes, you can see more of Kelechi and her work, which is essential. I'll be keeping up to date, and I think you'll definitely be coming back on the show. Well, hopefully, if you would like to.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, this has flown by. So, yeah, to have an opportunity to speak more about this, maybe when the work's developed a bit more and there's some kind of more publications out, just to talk about, that would be great.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Kelechi. And we'll see you next week, listeners. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Surviving Society.
To support our work, you can rate,
review and subscribe. To host or produce a series of Surviving Society,
get in touch with us via Twitter or Instagram.